Good morning. It's good to be back here with you guys. It feels like we haven't been together in a while, and so it's really cool to be with you and to gather together. And I hope that as we use this time intentionally to encourage and to lift up and to check in on one another, and of course that's what our hope communities are for as well. So if you're not yet plugged into one, we hope that you will be. It's where life on life happens here at Hope Valley, and so hope that you'll get plugged in to one of those. And I had some cool conversations this past week with some others that are outside the church that are really searching and really in a hard spot and are hoping to get plugged into one of our groups this next week. So be praying for opportunities like that. Again, like we've been praying recently, ask God to open your eyes to opportunities that He gives us, to people that we meet throughout the week that desperately need the love and the hope that's found in Jesus. So be looking for those opportunities because He gives them to us. And then pray for the courage and the boldness to take those opportunities and be a light in our valley. So did you realize that in America today, child abuse is reported every year about 7.4 million children are impacted by some form of child abuse, whether that's neglect, sexual abuse, physical abuse, verbal, 7.4 million children every single year. Between 5 and 6 children die, listen, every single day from some sort of child abuse. 70% of these children are under the age of 3. In fact, right now, we've been impacted in our own valley this week with that same reality. A little precious 2-year-old boy who's no longer alive as a result of physical and sexual abuse. Every single year in America, more than 1 million babies are aborted, killed. Every single year. That amounts to about 3,000 every single day. In fact, in the world today, from the time that we started the service to right now, more than 1,200 babies have already been killed today since we just started this service. So we've got a real problem in our society in America and also around the world. We have a real big heart problem. But that's not all. Human trafficking is now the second largest organized crime in the world. And now there are an estimated 40 million, actually more than 40 million slaves in the world today. That's actually more than any other time in history. So right now, in America and other countries, there's more than 40 million people who are in some form of slavery, whether it's sex trafficking or forced labor, trapped in a situation that they can't get out of. And that's happening not decades ago, but it's happening right now. This morning is what we call Sanctity of Human Life Sunday. And it's a day that we sort of set apart from the rest of the year to focus in on and reflect on the realities of how life is understood and treated in our world, specifically in America, and then what the church's response to that should be. What should our response be to this reality that's going on right now? What should our response be as the church body here in the New River Valley? And so we're going to look at that as we go on. We're going to look at what that even means to say the sanctity of human life. We're going to look at that in a minute. But what's interesting is that we didn't really plan it this way, but it directly ties into our text this morning as we're continuing our series through the book of Exodus. So you can go ahead and turn there. We're going to continue in Exodus chapter 1. Pastor Kevin last week did a great job of sort of setting the stage for our sermon series through the book of Exodus, really trying to help us get to where the people of Israel were in Genesis, leaving off, and then where we find them in Exodus chapter 1. Last week we looked at their current situation. They found themselves enslaved to the people of Egypt. We looked at God's purposes in difficulty and hard times, and ultimately we see that a lot of times God will bring his people through difficulty in order to get them to a place of blessing. And that's what we're going to see through the life of Israel here, that they walk through this and that God had even planned this difficult time for them because of where he was going to take them to and what he wanted to accomplish in them. And so then we look in our own hearts and say, okay, Lord, I understand that the difficulties that I'm walking through now, they don't feel good and they don't seem good, but I know that you can take them and use them for my good and for your glory in my life. So when we get to this passage in Exodus, what we're going to do this morning is we're going to sort of recap a little bit and then go into the next part of chapter 1 and what we see the Pharaoh doing to the people who are now enslaved. So beginning in verse 8, where Kevin was last week, we see that there's a new king, a Pharaoh over the land of Egypt, where the children of Israel are living. So they're there. They've been there for 400 some years, or nearly 400 years, and now the situation has changed. A new Pharaoh's there, doesn't know Joseph, doesn't care anything about the God of Israel. And so now he has decided to put them into slavery, rule over them because of his fear of how mighty they were growing. And so it says that there's a new king there, and he's placed them. So he has this Pharaoh has an objective. He's got a plan. He's got a plan to basically suppress and oppress the people of God because he's fearful of them. He's fearful of how fast they're growing, how fast they're multiplying. Pastor Kevin looked at that last week or on Sunday morning last week when we were on live stream on how basically they were growing and multiplying faster than they could even keep control. And so they were worried of what if there's an uprising, or what if they join one of our enemies, and what if they come against us? So we've got to do something. So he's got a plan, a four-part plan. The first tactic that he tries is oppression. The first tactic is that we look in verse 11, and it says, "So therefore the Pharaoh set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. And they built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses." But listen, I love this. "But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel." So, all right, so number one doesn't work. The more they were oppressed, the more that God blessed them, and the more that they multiplied. So that's not working. That's not working. So then plan number two is to put them into intense, ruthless slavery. Look at verse 13. "So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves, and they made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. And in all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves." So second try, okay? So now we're just going to completely pile on them work. And they ended up building all these cities for them because of all the labor that they were pouring on them. Number two doesn't work. So now he's got to figure something else out. That gets us to verse 15. So then he says, "Then the king of Egypt," so it's a progression, "said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other who was Puah, 'When you serve as midwives to the Hebrew women and you see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it's a daughter, she shall live.'" So try number three. All right, so now we're going to tell the midwives at birth, all right, so we can't control this, so we're going to have to kill them. So he resorts to genocide. And so he's saying to these midwives, okay, now try number three. When you see a little baby boy, and as they're being born, when you find out that it's a boy, you are to put that child to death. Well, look, verse 17 says, "But the midwives feared God." We're going to come back to that. That's probably paramount to this passage. "But they feared God, and they did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the male children live." Plan number three did not work. Let's use the midwives and let's kill these kids before they have a chance to grow and overpower us. Doesn't work. "So then the king of Egypt called the midwives to them. 'What have you done that you're letting these male children live?' And so they said to the Pharaoh, 'Because the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwives even come to them.' So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied." You see the continuation. They're multiplied, and they grew very strong. "Because the midwives feared God, he gave them families." So then, tactic number four. Then Pharaoh commanded all of his people, every person in Egypt, he commanded them, every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but every daughter you shall live. So now we've got not a secretive, let's let the midwives work and take care of these kids. Now it's a massive, nationwide charge to genocide and destroy these Hebrew boys. Up until now, this Pharaoh is the worst person in the Bible that we've come across. The most wicked, the most scheming, to doing whatever it takes to preserve his name and his kingdom. He's now resorting to commanding. So you got to think about that. What then was the moral climate of that day then? If you got the king, the president, the whatever, the ruler commanding the people, if you see a little baby Hebrew boy, what do you do? Doesn't matter who you are. You take them and you throw them and you murder them in the Nile River. That's what he's commanding his own people to do. I can't imagine. Well, we kind of can't imagine in the current state of America, where babies are just seen as something that can be thrown away. Something that if it's not convenient, if it's not the right timing, then, well, let's just throw them away. Let's just throw them away. But we're going to learn this morning about what makes that so horrific and what makes that so wrong in just a few minutes. But I want to go back to verse 17 because this is the biggest point of this passage. And it says, but the midwives feared God. So Pharaoh had a plan. He wanted to destroy these kids. He was going to use these midwives, but they feared God. Biblical fear is not what we often think of as fear today when someone's afraid of something. It's not that they were scared. So when Scripture and you read in the Old Testament, it says and they were God-fearers or they feared the Lord, it's not that they were scared of like a prisoner who's afraid of being tortured or the torture guy coming in to hurt them. It's not that kind of fear. It's the picture of a child that is in respecting and reverencing their authority of their parents and that they don't want to disappoint or go against or in fear of disappointing or disrespecting the authority that their parents have. That's the picture that we have of a holy fear of God in the Scriptures. It's in reverence to the all-powerful, almighty, sovereign God of the universe that they submitted their lives under. And so what they said essentially is, yes, there's a Pharaoh who has commanded us to do something, but we fear God more than we fear this man. Now, I want you to think about that for a minute, because this, at this time, Pharaoh was the most influential, most powerful person in the known world. Which means if Pharaoh just nodded his head, he could have your head chopped off. Like that's how much power that this Pharaoh had. So if anybody in the kingdom was to be feared, it was the king of Egypt. It was Pharaoh. So if they should have been fearful of anyone, it would have been him. But it says they feared God. And there's several reasons for that. But we have a challenge in our world today. And I know in my own heart, I deal with it all the time. It's this, the fear of God versus the fear of man, right? The fear of what will people think about me? In fact, that's what paralyzes us oftentimes in our witness, in our workplace and in our community, in our families, in our neighborhoods, is because we're afraid of what somebody else might think about me. Well, so if I say this, is that going to be offensive? Is that going to hurt them? Or is it going to, like, are they going to view me differently? Is it going to get awkward really weird? Is it, you know, really quickly? And so we have this fear of man. In fact, I deal with it all the time. when I'm having conversations with, in fact, there's certain conversations that as a pastor you have to have, but they're really hard because there's a fear of man that, man, I don't want to disappoint them. I don't want to hurt them. Or even communicating. There's this idea, well, you know, will they like me? Will they think I'm funny? Will they think it's good? Will they going to be bored? Are they going to fall asleep? Like, there's this fear of man that oftentimes impacts the way that we live. My dad, the very first sermon that I ever preached when I was about 16, my dad came up, because again, I was just scared to death. I was just so worried. I was like, this is going to be terrible. It's going to be a disaster. And I was just so worried. But he came up to me and said, Jared, there's only one thing that you need to remember. And he said, Jared, remember that you have nothing to prove. You have no one to impress. And you have only Jesus to please. Let that sink in. You have nothing to prove, no one to impress, and only Jesus to please. Here's what my dad was telling me. He was saying, there's only one opinion that matters. Not those that are going to be listening to you, not those that are going to be maybe you're worried about, that is it going to be, you know, the most theologically correct? There's just Jesus. There's an audience of one. And so my responsibility as I open the Word of God is not to please man, but to please God. But so many times the fear of man can be paralyzing. And then later on, I remember after I graduated seminary, I was in my ordination council, like all these pastors, and they're drilling you with theological questions, and I'm like all worried, and oh no, they're, you know, am I going to be a heretic? And Dad's like, Jared, you've got nothing to prove, you've got no one to impress, and you have only Jesus to please. So ultimately, it doesn't really matter what people think about me, but it matters infinitely what God thinks about me. It doesn't really matter what your family, ultimately at the end of the day, what your family thinks about you, what your boss thinks about you, what your neighbor thinks about you, but it matters infinitely what God thinks about you and me. And so these midwives risked their life because it didn't matter what Pharaoh thought, it didn't matter what the kingdom thought, it matters what the one true God in Israel thought. And they would have known, just like it says in Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, when God said, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. And they would have known the teaching of the God of Israel, and they would have said, no. I will not do this because of what God has said. So then, they did not obey Pharaoh because they feared, respected, and obeyed the one true God. So they saved the babies because they feared the one who created the babies. You see, the main point here is that the midwives valued life out of fear and reverence of God who created life in his own image. That's the principle here. They valued the life that God created more than they valued their own lives that they were risking, that Pharaoh could instantly take. I want to transition into our discussion on the sanctity of human life because there's a big question here, because we at church talk about this all the time. We talk about life, we talk about human life, and it's what when God says in Romans, I mean in Genesis 9, about if you kill a person by you shed the blood of an innocent human being, your blood then will be shed. He's drawing a distinction then between killing a person and killing a deer, right? There's a significant, profound difference in the two lives. But the question is why? The question that we have to answer, and that we have to answer in our society, and we're going to talk about this in our Hope Communities this week because it's so important. Why? Why is it different? Why is it wrong to kill babies? Because that's a discussion that's legitimately going on in our world and right now. What's wrong with taking the life of a baby in the womb? So we're going to ask some questions. Why is it wrong to take the life of a baby? What does it matter? Here's the answer. And then we're going to look why. The answer is, because they are, the very lives are sacred and special. Their very lives are sacred and special. When we talk about the sanctity of human life means that all life is sacred, holy, precious, and valuable. Every life. Every human life is sacred, holy, precious, and valuable. The next question then, it follows, okay, well then what, then why? Then what makes human life sacred, holy, precious, and valuable? Because we have to answer that question as well. So we believe that foundationally, but why is that? Let me tell you a couple reasons what it's not, okay? What does not make human life valuable, sacred, holy, and precious? One thing that is not, that's often used, is just potentiality. So this is actually an argument that a lot of Christians use, and we use a lot of times in defense of or defense against abortion. Potentiality is just the possibility that this life could develop into something special or something important or something valuable. And here's where we got to be careful, because it's, I don't want to downgrade personal testimonies, but for example, a couple years ago, there was a Super Bowl ad with Tim Tebow. I'm not sure if you ever saw that one or heard about it. It was a pro-life ad that aired during the Super Bowl that was the testimony of Tim Tebow's mom. I think her name was Pam, and that she, when she was pregnant, they told her, you have basically a lump of cells, it's like a tumor, and it's not going to develop into anything, and if you go full term, it's probably going to kill you, so you should abort this baby. Well, they didn't abort the baby because they had fundamental Christian beliefs, and they believed that there was a life, and they trusted in God, and so she did carry to term, and she did have a healthy baby, and the baby is Tim Tebow, who's now one of the greatest college quarterbacks of all time. He was an NFL quarterback. Now he's a baseball player, ironically. But you got Tim Tebow, and so then here's the danger. You lift him up. Whoa! You see what he became? Man, therefore abortion's wrong. Now hear me. Abortion is wrong. But not because of potentiality, not because he became a famous quarterback. Right? Just because he became a famous quarterback does not give value to his life. He had value to his life if he had become a garbage dump driver, right? So we got to be careful that place value on a baby's life based on what it could become one day. So it's not potentiality. It's not even government or scientific definitions. And so these things change all the time. About what is life, what makes life. And so whether you have a society or a government that decides when life begins or when it doesn't begin or when it's a human life and when it's not a human life, and we're going to talk about this in our Hope communities as well, that does not define and make that life valuable or sacred or special. It doesn't matter when they define what quality of life that baby's going to have. Does not give that life purpose and meaning and significance. That's not what makes it sacred. It's not even the emotional connection that makes it special and unique and sacred. I can remember for years after Danielle and I got married, there was a season of life there where we didn't know if we were going to have children. We were having a lot of difficulty, and that brought a lot of hurt. So around us, all my brothers' family were having babies, and all of our friends at seminary were having babies, and it seemed like every single month that went by was more disappointment and more hurt, and then a year went by and it kept on going, and before long we were just like, it was really hard. And then one day, I can still remember it, it's just incredible. One day, just a miracle of God, I'm downstairs in the living room. I didn't even know Danielle what she was doing upstairs. She had taken a pregnancy test because she was feeling a little bit strange. She comes running down the stairs just crying her eyes out. I'm like trying to figure out what in the world's wrong. Something's happened. Something's going on. And I'm like, what is it? And she just throws this pregnancy test in my face. And I'm like, what am I looking at? What is it? I don't know. What's happening here? And she's like, baby, we're pregnant. And I just remember I just began to weep, and we just began to hug each other, and we got down and just began to thank the Lord Jesus for this precious life that we didn't even know if we were going to be able to have. And that God blessed us, and we just were just crying and thanking Jesus. It was so much emotion that was wrapped up into that event. And then I remember the first day that when Emma was born and we got to lay eyes on her. And I remember the overwhelming love that I had. I couldn't believe that somebody I just met, I could have so much love and compassion for. And I was just like a blown away at the amount of love that I could have for a little baby that had just been born. But you know the amount of love that I had, that we had and have for our little girls. Even that love is not what makes that life valuable or precious or sacred. So what is it then? What is it that makes every single human life valuable, sacred, precious in the sight of God? I want you to turn to Genesis chapter 1. From the very beginning of creation, we learn what makes us unique and special. Genesis 1, verse 26. And then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created a male and female. He created them. What makes us unique and special and sacred and valuable is that God created you and me different than he created anything else. So when he created the world and the trees and the animals and the stars and the sky, and when he created everything, spoke everything into existence, and then he created mankind, he created us differently than he created anything else. We were created in the very image of God. We don't fully know. In fact, theologians have debated and talked about the fullness of what that means to be created in the image of God. And I can't begin to unpack all of that right now and the different possibilities. But here's what we do know at the very minimum about what it means to be created in the image of God. It means that we have been created with the capacity to know God, to love him, and to reflect him. It means attributes of God that we can then be poured out and reflected in our life. Things that other things in creation will never have. Like God created the butterfly, right? And he created it beautifully. And it's so incredible to see the lifestyles of a butterfly and how it glorifies God in the way that it flies and it the beauty of the wings. But a butterfly will never experience the love and intimate redemptive relationship with its creator. It never will. Because it wasn't created in the image of God. Same thing for a squirrel. The same thing for any of these things. They will never experience the redeeming, loving, intimate relationship with the God who created them. So we've been created in the image of God, and it separates us from everything else on earth. We have the capacity to know him, to love him, to have this relationship with him, and then in that relationship to reflect his goodness throughout the entire earth. Now, it is true, though, because of the fall, that image of God in us has been distorted. It's not gone, it's not broken, but it has been distorted. And so we learn in the New Testament that through Jesus, that image of God is being restored, is being renewed. And then one day, ultimately, it will be fully redeemed when we're with Jesus. But until that day, we are still created in the image of God as his image bearers. So that has huge implications then for the life of a little baby that's not even born yet to the oldest person in the world who's on their deathbed. They're still image bearers of God. Whether they can have even cognitive understanding of what's going on around them or whether they yet have taken their first step. So here's important. Being pro-life, please hear me, being pro-life is not just about babies. Right? It's about everything that's been created in the image of God. It's about how all life, it's not just little itty-bitty babies, it's children, it's women, it's refugees, it's immigrants. Yes, the legal ones and the illegal ones. It's all of life is precious in the sight of God. It's the hurting, it's the poor, it's the disabled. That's what it means to be pro-life. So when we gather together under the name pro-life, be careful that it's not just a one little issue thing about abortion, because that's not all that it is. It's about life as a whole. And so because we've been made in the image of God, that's what makes everything, that's the answer, right? That's why it's wrong to kill babies. That's what makes what happened this past week so horrific. And that we had a precious 2-year-old boy who was abused by his own parents and then ultimately killed. It's what makes racism wrong. It's what makes slavery wrong. It makes a mockery of God's creation, and it treats as trash what God has made as intrinsically special in his sight. The way I wanted to end this today, as we're thinking through the value of every human life, is how we then as a church can respond to that. So a couple ways that we're going to do that. In our Hope communities this week, we're going to be discussing this. We're going to be looking at some actually popular arguments that go against our arguments for human life and about when it begins and what constitutes a human life. Another way that I want us to do that is to think through people in our own community that are responding to this issue. And so we have one organization called the Pregnancy Resource Center of the New River Valley. You've probably come in contact with them before or seen their things on Facebook, but they are an organization that exists to help mothers that have babies that are pregnant and they're scared or they're worried, they don't know what to do, and they're having those difficult decisions to make. And so they are specifically getting involved in those families, those lives. I want you to watch a video that gives a snapshot of what the PRC is and does. I'm going to have Penny and Amanda come up, and we're going to ask them a few questions about how we as a church can be involved in that.
I think a little support at a key time in your life can totally change the landscape of your decision-making.
When I came, it was because I thought I was pregnant.
She was scared, I was scared. No one's really ready for a kid.
He was more shocked than anything.
Pretty much.
I was a little nervous, but when I seen the heartbeat and I seen the shape of the baby, I just like fell in love from that day. It made me be proud of being a father. The prayers help, the support, especially when you're in college.
What they need to know is that they are not alone. Who's going to show them the way forward?
I want to tell my counselor how much I appreciate her.
It's just been a blessing to come here and to welcome arms.
That seemed to give me a lot of hope.
Are you ready? Say, we count.
It's not on us to have the right words, because it is God. He is in control of the situation. He brought the people there who need to be there. He will provide everything else. That all we have to do is be obedient to his will.
We are called to love God and to love others, and what's so beautiful about this ministry is that we put that into practice.
Courage is always easy to follow. I admire the courage of PRC, and it's easy to follow.
Nine out of ten
chose to parent.
One person at a time.
Step up.
Tell a client,
I believe in you.
You can count me in.
All right, so I recognize somebody on that video. I don't know if you, yeah. All right, so I have a couple questions, and I'm going to let them sort of speak. So,
I like that side much better.
You thought you were going to get away with it. There you go. All right. So, tell us then, first of all, how did you guys get connected with the PRC? And then, like, what is your current involvement there?
So, I started out as an intern there, and so it just gradually progressed into actually being an employee there. It's kind of a long story, but so now I'm a client advocate, and so my job is basically to be a counselor. I work with the Earn While You Learn program, which is the parenting classes, and I also work with the pregnancy tests and ultrasounds and the STI appointments as well. And so I'm just there to support and to try to help the people who come in to, I guess, just take a step back from the situation that they're in and help them see the big picture and look at their options and just try to show the love of God to them in the scary situation that they're in.
Well, for me, I'm a little bit newer to the actual on staff position. I just recently put in my 2 weeks so far, so I work on Tuesdays there. But I feel like my heart for the PRC has just been longing for a really long time. I know most of you know us, but we have 5 kiddos and I homeschool them, and so I have stepped away from the nursing role to minister to them because our children are our ministry. So recently, with the Lord's pushing, because it had to definitely be the Lord, a position has been open for a staff nurse. And so I applied for that. And 2 weeks ago, officially January 8th, I started working at the PRC there as a staff nurse. And so what that means... Oh, thanks, Jerry.
They got me to see you.
So I like that. So for me, what that means, Amanda, as she said, she's a client advocate. So she is the first to meet patients, and she deals with just their demographics, what brings them in and such, kind of where they are spiritually, and then they bring that information to us as the nurses, and we go in to help with whatever reason they're there that day. And that's 3 main things. We do pregnancy tests. If it's a confirmed test, we do ultrasounds, very limited ultrasounds. And then we also do STI testing. And starting this week, we will be treating those positive. We test for 2 STIs, and we will treat for those as well. But, like I say, my heart for it has been there a long time. I truly believe that children are a gift from the Lord. And they're not a mistake, and the Lord knew them even before they were formed. And so my hope, my role, my desired outcome as a staff nurse there is just to help them feel loved and not that they're not alone and that there is options, that abortion is not the only way, because we are there for them through birth into their, like Amanda talked about, Earn While You Learn. So it's even through their first years.
So if somebody finds out that they see a friend through Facebook or somewhere that is in need, they can just point them to you guys and then connect them with y'all and y'all can get them connected. That'd be a way.
Yeah, a lot of it is actually I did some class work last night watching DVDs, and a big portion of this is through social media. And so they do their appointments through social media. We are right next to Radford University, and so, like the video said, the majority, and Amanda probably knows more about that, the majority of them are students. And they come back this week, so we anticipate kind of a higher number. But you might be able to answer differently, but I do know friend to friend to friends is how I have heard.
Definitely word of mouth is still, like, the number one way that we receive clients and just stuff like that, so...
All right, so another question. What were some specific ways that we as a church could be praying for you guys and the PRC?
So prayer is definitely is the biggest need that we have. And, I mean, without prayer, we can't do what we do. And so some of the things that you can be praying for is, for one thing, just the staff and the volunteers, that we would be bold and that we would remember why we're there. You know, sometimes through the day-to-day routine and stuff, it's easy to, you know, forget why we're there. And so just pray that as staff and as volunteers that we will keep that in mind and keep focus on the Lord and what His will is for that day. And also just that we also need some more just like volunteers and stuff. And and also we have some positions open as well. And so just praying for the right people to come in and just that those positions will be filled and that God will just fulfill those things.
Okay. And then last question would be, what are some ways that we can volunteer and get involved?
So, you know, when we think about that, a lot of people are probably like, well, I'm not a nurse or I don't have, you know, training in counseling, but there's still a place for you. They can train you to be a client advocate, and those are always needed. The more client advocates we have, more patients we're able to, or clients, sorry, that is the nursing brain. That's probably going to be one of the harder things for me to transition from, but our clients to be seen. IT, there's always, there are definitely computer issues there, and so if you have an IT mind, call the PRC and see if there's something there that you could help with. Folding clothes, sorting clothes, there are constant, just in the days that I interviewed and the 2 days I've been there, people are constantly bringing in items, whether that's new things or gently used things. And they have a neat, I work in the Radford office, and it's they have the whole downstairs is their Earn While You Learn program, and they have a store. So the Earn While You Learn program, they go and they watch videos and they earn dollars. And then they can go to the store and shop. So they can do clothes, diapers, so volunteering those things. As you'll see on this picture, this was done in our Hope community over a month or so, and it's called a baby shower in a basket. And so it has everything that that mom will need for the first year, along with a Bible. And these are all given to all families who have been through the program, correct, when their baby delivers, they give this back to them. So just material-wise, that's something. Financially, you can go on to the PRC support.com, and that will give you ability to donate, you know, monetarily online. It'll show you what jobs are available. They do have another part-time nursing position available. They have a I don't know where that is. There's multiple things. Client advocate and a director of advertising or something like that. So, and a lot of those, most of them all are part-time. Amanda, you work 2 days a week this semester with school, right? I work on Tuesdays, and there's only the nurse manager and the CEO work full-time. So it's real doable. They'll work with you on the hours.
Good deal.
Yeah, and the Earn While You Learn program is really awesome because even this last Tuesday when I was there, a mom came in. She brings her kids with her, so she had like a three-year-old probably, and the newborn, and she watches these videos and earns. And that's the main thing there is building relationship. I mean, that's our desire. When these clients first come through the door, you're not going to just... You might have that rare occasion where they immediately turn and follow Jesus, but it's just like with our Hope communities. Relationship is so important. And when a lot of those girls come in first, they're terrified. I know one particular girl that I saw this past Tuesday, you could just see how scared and lost. She was scared. She was lonely. She didn't know what was going to happen. And so just to be a non-judgmental, just being the feet, hands and feet of Jesus and loving. And helping them know that there is something beyond abortion, that there, whether that's something you decide to keep your child or adoption. So those options are always being, you know, spoken about there as well.
So speaking of building relationships with them, a couple of ideas that Debbie, the director, gave us is teaching classes for them. And so we've talked about maybe even as a church, and if you have interest, let me know. They've specifically mentioned maybe like having a parenting class or a financial peace class, a financial class. That way, that would give us more time to actually have face time with the clients and have time with them.
Yeah, and if I can add to that, so that's the big thing. It is more time, because you may not get straight into the gospel conversation the first time. And so with these classes, the desire is, you know, say you're really good with finances, and we decide, okay, twice a month there's going to be a financial class that they can come to, like a Dave Ramsey. She will get clients to sign up. When that class is full, then you decide, well, beforehand you can decide what days you want to have it. You finish that class, then you say, hey, let's have a gathering. Bring your family, and we'll just celebrate what's been done, and we'll have a lunch in a just low-key fashion. And then from there, inviting them to church and getting them involved.
Yep. So. Awesome. Anything else?
I just know that they did a cooking class, and so it doesn't have to be anything. And it was just like a one-time thing that they did. So, but yeah.
All right, well, thank you guys.
I mean, they just help. Because they are, it is volunteering, like Amanda actually said it. The more volunteers and the more people that just are giving of their time, those are more resources that they have for these clients that are coming in. Because the ultrasounds that we do, they're free. The pregnancy test, these STI testings, the treatment we get, it's all free. It's funded through people who've chosen to give of their time and their resources.
Thank you guys very, very much. All right, so those are just some simple ways that we can, as a church, as individuals, serve. If any of those things resonate with you, just come talk to one of these, whether it's Penny or Amanda, and we could get set up on ways that we can help, maybe even as a Hope community, come together. Worship team, you guys come on up. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to close out our worship service, our time together, with just time of prayer together. We're going to sing. My closing is this. As we think through how God created life, that every life is precious in His sight, from conception to taking the final breath on the earth, what does that mean for us to fight for life? And what does that mean for you? So as we have this time to pray, and then let me also say this: there are those ladies, women who have gone through abortions, and it changes their life. And so now they walk around and they feel shame and guilt, and they're walking in that when that is not God's desire for them. And so you might know somebody right now who's walked that road, and maybe they're feeling condemned by the church, or maybe even on a day like this when it's like, oh, we're against abortion, but we're never against them. And so we want to come alongside them and say, yes, there is no condemnation in Christ Jesus, and He died for you to redeem you from the shackles and chains of sin. And so as we close, just think of ways and pray, Lord, is there ways that I can be involved in treasuring life that You have created and placed in my life?